Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Thursday, the 16th of July. An article in the Wall Street Journal on July 14 caught our attention, titled "The Culture War's New Front, U.S. History Classes in Texas." The fight over school curriculum in Texas has entered a new arena, the article starts, with a brewing debate over how much faith belongs in American history classrooms. The Texas Board of Education recently approved new science standards, and I'm sure you're aware that it was somewhat controversial, making room for creationist critiques of evolution. And now they're looking at the social studies curriculum. Three reviewers who have been appointed by social conservatives have recommended revamping the K-12 curriculum to emphasize the roles of the Bible, the Christian faith, and the civic virtue of religion in the study of American history. Two of those appointees want to remove or de-emphasize references to several historical figures who have become icons, Cesar Chavez and Thurgood Marshall. One of them, a Christian minister, has said we're in an all-out moral and spiritual civil war for the soul of America. So it got us thinking about how history is taught in states throughout the country and who advises. When is it up to the teacher? When is it up to the school board? And how much weight is given to a review panel like the one in Texas? Our guest this hour is Professor Luther Speer. He is in the Department of Education, senior lecturer in education and history, and director of undergraduate studies at Brown University. His work is on the history of education, and he focuses primarily on the history of American school reform in the 20th century and in the history of higher education, on changing definitions of academic freedom, and I find this interesting, also working on issues involving teaching history and how to use primary sources to help students learn to think historically. We'll be welcoming phone calls for Professor Speer, as we always do for all of our guests. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. The email address is talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. Hello, Professor Speer. Thanks so much for being with us.
Hello. Thanks for inviting me.
Did this story strike you as well in Texas? I guess I wasn't aware of how Texas selects their social studies books, but it's interesting they have all these reviewers who obviously have their own political agendas, which it seems to me can create some problems in how you go about learning history.
Well, Texas has a long history of involvement by groups like this. Decades ago, a couple named Mel and Norma Gabler were the most prominent textbook reviewers in the state, and they had an enormous influence on what textbooks were put on the permitted list and what textbooks were excluded. And they had an enormous influence as well, because Texas's market is so big, on what the textbook publishers put into their textbooks. So they've been at it a long time. Texas and California are the two big markets that have a state adoption system, so they have an enormous impact on the textbook writing as well as the textbook selling.
So it really has an impact on states all over the country.
Absolutely.
Hmm. And what about this process that they use? They have reviewers. Who decides who a reviewer is going to be? Is it unusual to have people who are from the Christian right being reviewers of history textbooks, and then they have some liberals? I don't know how they do this and why they do it this way.
Well, I'm not a policy expert on Texas in particular or on state reviewing systems in general, but I can tell you that any state that you can name is going to have people who take a look at it. I think Texas has a more, shall we say, open system that allows people who are not historians to have a lot more influence than might be the case in other states.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting that three of the members of this review board are professors of history or education at universities in Texas, and three are appointed by social conservatives. If this influence is so widespread in the country, these people carry a lot of weight.
Well, they do. There's a certain amount of canceling out that takes place. The best book, if your listeners are interested on the subject of textbooks in particular, is Diane Ravitch's The Language Police. And she talks about how both the left and the right have influenced textbook publishers and have either directly or indirectly gotten changes to be made, so that basically textbooks these days are pretty watered down and have been for a long time. There are some people who were lobbying against too much religion in the textbooks, and so, for example, you would have people talking about the people who arrived in Massachusetts in 1620 as the Pilgrims, and they would simply be defined as pilgrims or people who take a journey.
Mm.
And the religion is left out.
Uh-huh.
So, again, the general blandness of the textbooks results from publishers and states being responsive to these pressure groups, and these pressure groups may or may not have any kind of professional historical background that they bring to bear, but they obviously have very strong feelings, and it is the public education system and the public feels that it should be involved, and this historically goes back a long, long time.
Right. And who do you think should be designing our textbooks for history?
Who should be?
Yes.
I think we need two things. I think first we need to have textbooks that are designed by professional historians, but I think more than that, I think we need to understand that teaching history in Texas or anywhere else involves a lot more than the textbook.
Mm-hmm.
The textbook itself should be only an auxiliary aid, and it's what other materials that the instructor brings to bear, most especially primary sources and the ability to get students to engage those sources, that make the difference in what is taught. There's a perverse sense in which we might tell the people in Texas that they really don't need to worry because all of those surveys that we have indicate that students don't really learn history anyway, that by the time they're out, they couldn't tell you which freedoms are protected by the First Amendment or who was the Secretary of State in George Washington's administration or any of those things. So historical ignorance suggests that textbooks in particular and history teaching in general is not very effective.
Interesting. So they don't know that because they weren't taught that, or they don't know that because of the dry manner in which it is taught, which makes it easy to forget?
I would argue for the second one, although the problem in the current educational environment is that history, because of No Child Left Behind, and its focus on language arts and math, has been pushed to the margins.
Right.
And so there's very little history teaching going on. I noticed that both the article in the Wall Street Journal and a lot of other discussions of this equate history and social studies. And in fact, those are not the same thing, obviously. And history is only a small part of what constitutes social studies standards in many states. And the apparent time that is spent on social studies is limited, and the time that's spent on history is only a fraction of that.
Mm-hmm. And is that new in our society?
I think the emphasis, particularly in the weaker schools, is, or the lack of emphasis, is new. I think we are recognizing that at this point, and there is some concern. People like David McCullough and the National Council for History Education have been lobbying heavily in Washington to get history onto the radar of NCLB, because the motto really is, if you want it to be taught, you'd better test it.
Mm-hmm.
And if history isn't being tested for NCLB validation, then it won't be taught as much.
Right. I've heard cases, I brought this up before, where teachers have to prepare for all of these tests, an increasing number of tests, and as a result, some history teachers I've talked to have had to eliminate events as important as the Vietnam War. They just have to skip it because they have to prepare students for the next round of testing.
Right, and most states for many years now have basically said, you will do American history 1 year in middle school, and frequently that means up to or through Reconstruction, and then 1 year in high school. Reconstruction, too, as close to the present as you can get, which in many cases means the end of World War II. And so history has really been on the back burner for a long time. The interesting thing is that the only reason history is required in the first place in many states is, if you go back to right after World War I, there was a real concern about patriotism, and during the first Red Scare of right after World War I, there were laws passed that indicated very strongly that history was going to be required, it was going to be taught, because that would make our students patriotic.
Oh.
And so that theme has been sounded for a long time.
Hmm. Mm-hmm. It's hard to imagine for me, and maybe I'm in a real exception, and of course for you because it's your profession, but it's hard to imagine a life lived without understanding of history. It seems to me to be a much less interesting life.
I would agree. If you don't have a sense of where you've come from, you really don't fully understand who you are. But there are an awful lot of other things that crowd the agenda in the schools. And what frequently happens is that we have people who come back to history later in their lives through reading people like David McCullough or Stephen Ambrose or Doris Kearns Goodwin and begin to wonder why it was that they weren't excited by it in the first place.
Right.
And the problem is that in the schools, it's not taught well and it's not taught often.
Mm-hmm.
It's not taught well because, as, again, Diane Ravitch has pointed out and others have as well, more than half of the people teaching history courses neither majored nor minored in history. So they are really tied to their textbooks.
More than half? Are you serious?
The only field that is less likely to have someone who is a master of the discipline teaching it is physics.
So who's teaching?
Well, the standard joke in a lot of schools, the kid comes home to the parents on the first day, and the parents say, "So what's the name of your history teacher?" And the student says, "Coach."
Oh, no.
And that doesn't intend to denigrate the role of coaches. Coaches are important, but when your main concern is keeping the volleyball pumped up and getting to the practice field after school, that tells you that history isn't your first priority. And history is, Ted Sizer has said, and I'll quote Ted because he was chair of the Brown History Department and founder of the Coalition of Essential Schools, Ted Sizer has said that history is the hardest subject to teach well at the high school level.
Mm-hmm.
And I've visited dozens of classrooms, and I have seen far too many teachers who seem determined to prove him right.
Mm-hmm. And yet when we think, at least when I think about teachers who were important in my life, they were English teachers or they were history teachers.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's good. That's a good sign. Were you educated in Wisconsin?
No, Illinois.
Illinois.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Well, then you were lucky. I was lucky. I had some very, very good history teachers, but it was obviously their first priority in their professional lives.
Right.
And they cared about it, and they knew how to transmit it. And they didn't think of it, and that's what's interesting about this Wall Street Journal article, is that once again we're hearing people say that what history is about is the transmission of facts, and presumably those facts will lead to students having the attitudes of which the advocates approve. And it doesn't work that way, and it will never work that way. And it's a good way to make things boring. When I work with prospective or apprentice history teachers, we talk about the different kinds of questions that you can ask students. And you can ask them factual questions. You can ask them questions that are intended to make them connect events. You know, what does the Kansas-Nebraska Act have to do with the formation of the Republican Party? Or you can ask them interpretive questions. You actually have to ask all of those. The most complicated, sophisticated, and interesting questions are the interpretive ones.
Mm-hmm.
What was the main reason that the Civil War occurred?
Mm-hmm.
That's an interpretive question, obviously. But you can't get there without using evidence. And most teachers never get past the questions about evidence. They'll, instead of asking about the interpretations of the Civil War, they'll talk about which came first, the Kansas-Nebraska Act or the formation of the Republican Party or stuff like that. And
right. That
is sleep-inducing.
I see your point. Is there another reason, perhaps, and the Texas situation points to this, that the teaching of history has become so political that people are thinking it's not worth it. Let's just not emphasize history because we can't decide, because of our different political persuasions, what's important to teach.
I think that's possible. I think people are a little tired of the culture wars. The interesting thing in Texas is that people on the right, at least, are not yet tired of it and are insisting that their way is the right way. To teach history effectively, you have to respect your students' ability to think and give them the right, after they've examined the evidence, to come to their own interpretations. And that requires considerable restraint on the part of the instructor. You can't give the impression to your students that there is one right interpretation and you have it. And the only way the student is going to get an A is by repeating it on the test.
Mm-hmm.
But that's not what these people want. What they want is an interpretation presented as fact. And you probably know that in the state of Florida, for instance, there's even a law on the books that says that teachers of history classes will teach only facts. What can you say in that particular case?
Right.
It's oversimplified, to say the least.
Let's welcome phone calls. We're talking about history, the importance of teaching history, of learning history, why it is it's not emphasized, the politics surrounding this, our interest in this particular subject, sparked by the Wall Street Journal article just a couple days ago, July 14, the Culture Wars New Front, U.S. history classes in Texas. They have appointed six reviewers, three appointed by social conservatives who have been recommending revamping the K-12 curriculum to emphasize the roles of the Bible, the Christian faith, the civic virtue of religion in the study of American history. Three reviewers have been appointed by moderate and liberal school board members, all professors of history or education at Texas University. And this is a national issue because, as you heard the professor say, there are so many people who live in Texas and in California that school books designed in both of those states have a tendency to become the books that are used in other states. So the politics behind this is rather important. We have one line open if you'd like to join the conversation. The number here is 800-486-8655, or use the email if you'd like, and that's talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. Professor Luther Spear is our guest this hour, senior lecturer in education and history and director of undergraduate studies at the Department of Education at Brown University. His interests in the history of education, focusing on the history of American school reform in the 20th century, the history of higher education, and he's working on issues involved in teaching history. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Let's go to phone calls now for Professor Spear. We start with Clark from Milwaukee. Hello, Clark.
Hi.
Hi.
What I was going to say is, with these people who are advocating for emphasis on the Christian faith in U.S. history textbooks, I would say that a lot of grade school U.S. history textbooks are already biblical enough in a way. There's a book called Lies My Teacher Told Me by James Lowen, which I think is really excellent, and it's pretty short and easy to read, but it just goes into the fact that a lot of grade school U.S. history textbooks are so skewed by patriotism. We turn these explorers and these presidents into almost godlike figures, and the story of our country kind of turns into this fairy tale. And I would say that religion, I mean, definitely did shape philosophy and influence some events, but if the people advocating for the emphasis of the role of the Bible and the Christian faith in U.S. history textbooks are the same people that were advocating for intelligent design, I would just say that that would further taint these U.S. history textbooks that already really aren't that great.
Professor Spear.
Well, there's a real difference, and I would agree that there was in the past a certain tendency in the direction that your caller Clark is talking about. There's a difference between teaching about religion and teaching religion. Certainly when you're talking about John Winthrop and the Puritans in Massachusetts, you're talking about people for whom religion was the very center of their lives. And understanding how and why that can be the case in what is now a very secular age is a challenge. The way to do that is not to simply dismiss it out of hand and say, well, you know, that isn't really the case. You have to look at the evidence to decide how important religion as a motivation was, for example, compared to, say, economic considerations. And the textbooks that we have now do not, because they're so afraid of offending people on the issue of religion, they do not have a consideration of religion as part of the lives of people, whether in the 17th century or the 19th century or presently. I think that's true. Lowen's book is interesting in some ways. It came out in 1994 and is critical of textbooks that go all the way back into the 50s and 60s. He even has one sentence at one point talking about slavery where he says, as recently as 1950, this was said about slavery. I would suggest that that's a little bit out of date.
Yeah, I would too.
Yeah. And the other point that I would make is that the goal of the people in Reverend Marshall's camp seems to be more than that. They not only want to have religious history as part of the narrative, they want it to be the narrative, and they want to argue, for example, the biblical origins of American society and the Constitution. That goes way too far. And one can look at the religious beliefs of the founders, for example, and see that the kinds of things that he would like to see aren't there. It does provide a kind of teachable moment for your students. Mm-hmm. If you can have them look at, for example, the fact that Jefferson edited the Gospels and took out the miracles, or that Benjamin Franklin had his How to Achieve Moral Perfection and equated Jesus and Socrates, that tells you that those founders in particular did not have the kind of religious beliefs that Reverend Marshall wants people to believe that the founders in general had.
Mm-hmm.
But that's a good exercise. You have students look at evidence, look at primary sources, and they can come to conclusions about the role of religion on their own.
Right. Thank you very much for your call. Let's go to Tom from Tomahawk next. Hi, Tom.
Well, you just said exactly what I was thinking. I taught a graduate course on the teaching of social studies and history for 20 years at a university. And one of the things I encouraged my teachers to do who were in the course is to analyze their textbooks. And it was amazing how many of them had ahas and said, oh, my God, how can they say that? You know, that's not even true. And so I encouraged them to have their students, as best they could, to dig into those facts, if you will, in those books and see how true they were. And some of them came up with amazing stuff where even middle kids were digging into sources and finding that the accounts of the battle at the in Texas, the Mexican-American War, was totally distorted by the textbook that they had. So and my encouragement to teachers was, go that route. Now, since No Child Left Behind is there, I know they're in a bind. They're in a terrible bind. But perhaps with people like you, Professor, and others, we can... I'm retired now, but we can push the field to move in that direction. Teachers in Madison, by the way, are saying No Child Left Behind testing is worthless. And let's hope that they get some, power behind them. That's all I wanted to say. I'll hang up and listen to your
comments.
Thank you, Tom.
Thanks for your call.
Yeah, I think that using the textbook as a kind of foil, not to show that it's wrong necessarily, but to show that it has a viewpoint and that even the most apparently neutral narrative, in fact, has an interpretation because the author has had to say, I'm going to emphasize this fact and not that one, or I'm going to leave it out. I would have middle school kids use documents like the ones that Joy Hakim in a wonderful series of volumes
called
The History
of Us. Oh, I remember
that series.
Yeah, it's great.
Yeah. She has, among many other things, two engravings that were done of the firing on Lexington Green, one by British sources and one by American sources.
Hmm.
And they're very different.
Mm-hmm.
They're both primary sources, and the students look at them and say, you know, what is the image that is being projected by each one? For my high school kids, and I taught high school for 18 years.
Oh, you did?
I taught high school and was a department chair. I taught AP U.S. History. I was a U.S. AP history consultant and co-authored a book on the document-based question, so I've been up to my elbows in high school history for a long time. And even the non-AP students could get into a question when looking at Thomas Bailey's famous textbook, The American Pageant. Why does he call the Civil War the War for Southern Independence? And the answer has to do with, among other things, the Gablers in Texas. You want to sell textbooks in the South? Don't call it the Civil War.
Oh, my gosh.
You have to find, you know, a way around that, one that will not alienate your northern readers, but won't alienate those southern readers either, because their money is green in both places.
Isn't that interesting? Thanks for the caller. Now, we have one line open if you'd like to join us. Our number is 800-486-8655. It's interesting, you were a teacher for a long period of time. I have a friend who teaches history at my son's high school here in Milwaukee. He goes to MPS, and I was asking him what the standards are here, how we decide what textbooks are. And it's a district-based decision in the state of Wisconsin. He says that he's given enormous latitude as a history teacher. He's expected to teach a course called U.S. History, but no one has ever told him what he should teach or how he should teach it. A question about the role of the teacher, and obviously you want all your history teachers to be superb and not to be the volleyball coaches and have their emphasis on volleyball. But what about the latitude of the teacher? How much latitude should a teacher have?
Well, I think once you have good ones, their professional judgment should be trusted. I don't think that anybody should be scripted. That's a good way to drive away your best teachers and keep people who are comfortable doing things by rote. And every class is different. I taught probably 50 different versions of the survey course, and even though it was called the survey in U.S. history, it was different each time because the mix of kids was different. And so you have to be able to find the baseline and reach those kids based on what they already know, and then get them to deal actively with the history that they're reading. If they consider history an already settled matter, so that what's in the textbook is the story, the master narrative, they won't particularly be interested unless the textbook is unusually well written, and most aren't. Most have this kind of impersonal voice that says, all these issues are settled, here's the story, now go take the multiple choice test.
Right. Scott from Sturgeon Bay, our next caller. Hi, Scott.
Hi. That actually was a nice segue into what I wanted to say. I had the experience several years ago in going to Boston. At that point in my adult life, I was just kind of starting to really tune into how much I had missed in terms of history, and I walked, I forget what they call it, there's a historical trail that goes actually through downtown Boston. And at one point, I was standing in what was the old State House, where the advisors to the British governor of Massachusetts met before the Revolution, and these people, many of whom became signers of the Declaration and stuff, would get together to give the governor advice. Well, they've turned it into a museum that's just a wonderful place because you see some of the early events leading to the Revolution, the Boston Massacre, the initial shots in Lexington and Concord, and you see them not only reported, but you also see them reported in the local Tory and Whig newspapers. Mm-hmm. And it, for the first time in my life, I realized these people were just like us. Somehow they, you know, as you grow, at least as I grew up, I thought, you know, somehow we're smarter than they were. It was simpler times. They didn't have as much on their mind, you know, and all this kind of elitist crap that was going through my head, apparently. But in any event, when you read these newspapers, you realize that the editorializing, the distortions, the unwillingness to report the whole story objectively, the desire to report and form the narrative at the same time, form the events in the public's mind, were just as prominent then as they are if you look at the difference between Fox and a strongly liberal news source now. And you realize that these were a few extraordinary people and a great many very average, ordinary people caught up in enormously complicated and historic events. And it suddenly made history something that, you know, could be going on around me right now, and maybe I don't really recognize it.
Oh,
and if we could learn to teach our children these amazing stories and relate them to the same kinds of events and the same kinds of moral dilemmas that we have to decide about now, I think we could grab them, at least some of them, more of them, and then fill in, after you tell the story, then you fill in the facts about the you know, they have to know about all the various acts and what was going on in Congress and that sort of stuff in a more detailed sort of a way. But you got to grab them with a story first. And I think that worked for me, and I think it would work for a lot of people. So I'll just take any response off the air.
Thank you, Scott.
I really think that's a very nice point. What Scott is talking about is what in the history biz these days we refer to as historical thinking. Students have to use some imagination to get into the heads of the people that they're studying, whether it's colonials at the time of the Revolution or the Pilgrims or whoever. And that takes real imagination, because there's an old quotation from a novel, "The past is a foreign country, they do things differently there." And so you have to really get into the idea that these are people who have viewpoints of their own, and that those viewpoints have to be understood before we can go on and make any other judgments about them. The other thing is that the people at the time, as your caller points out, had no idea of how this stuff was going to turn out. And the students who are studying it now have to try to get into that as well. They have to avoid what we call presentism. They have to not simply take our values and look at various people along the centuries and say, oh, well, they weren't as good as we are or as smart as we are, therefore they aren't worth studying. Just turn around and ask students, okay, how are things going to work out in Afghanistan? What's going to happen with health care? They don't know. And a lot of people didn't know how the revolution was going to turn out. Right. So when they signed at risk of their lives, their fortunes, and their sacred honor, they were really risking it. And that, I think, speaks to one of the two rules that I always suggest for apprentice teachers. My two rules for teaching history are: make it real, which is what this kind of historical thinking does, and make it matter.
Mm-hmm.
Students like to say, so what, when you bring up some fact that interests you. That's a really good question, and we need to have answers to that.
Mm-hmm. And sometimes it takes, you know, I just finished watching, I don't know what you thought of it, but I thought it was very well done, the John Adams, I was a little behind the times, documentary done on HBO, which I thought was very well acted. And as a great history teacher or a great book can teach you, and maybe for some young people, it's seeing it too these days, that it did just that. It answered the question, so what? It showed you how important it was and what great risk and hardship people were facing to have this revolution, and also some of the British viewpoint as well. I just thought, you know, it was one of those events I thought, wow, this is great.
I really agree with you.
You liked it too.
Oh, yeah. And if you can read or you can see that scene where he and his son are bracing themselves in the hold of the ship against the waves of the storm that's battering the ship outside, that makes it real.
Yeah, it sure did. It was good. All right, Ed from Wausau. Hello, Ed.
Hi.
Hi.
I had a parochial education, and they seemed to emphasize ancient history. But then I found when I started the university down in Madison, when I went up and took history courses, political science, even English courses, even speech courses, they still, you know, continued on from that ancient history. But I mean, our founding fathers essentially were, you know, going back to the Greeks and Romans. And I still, when I watch C-SPAN, I hear some of the older senators quoting, you know, what was said in Rome. I just think history is, it's a learning experience is what I learned after I got out of high school. But my question to the professor is, what are texts such as the People's History of the United States and also literature such as, you know, Mark Twain and things like that, how relevant, how do they fit in to history and the teaching of it?
Well, for a long time when I was teaching at the high school level, I coordinated my history course with the 11th grade American literature course. And a lot of high schools have that combination in the 11th grade. And so when she was teaching about Hawthorne and Poe and the romantic authors of the first half of the 19th century, I was instructing the students about Andrew Jackson and bringing up the question of whether Andrew Jackson might be considered a romantic hero. So there really is a linkage there. And more than that, when we talk about teaching history these days, we don't talk just about politics. We talk about social history and cultural history and what some of the French historians of years ago called total history. We're trying to bring it all in. And that's one of the unfortunate things about the Texas situation right now, is that there are people who seem to think that there's real history, that's political history, and maybe there are religious additives that they want to bring into the mix. But if you're going to talk about Cesar Chavez or you're going to talk about Thurgood Marshall, that somehow that's just an add-on and it's optional. And in fact, the history of African Americans in this country, or the history of other minorities, the history of women, is all part of the overall picture. And I would hate to be put in a position of having to choose between Billy Graham and Thurgood Marshall, as one of the people in the article is suggesting we have to do. I think they're both extremely important, and we need to have more time in our history classes to make that point clear and to give our students a chance to study them.
Mm-hmm. And sometimes nobody has enough time for this kind of thing. I was struck, I didn't watch all of the game, but I was watching some of the All-Star game and was so struck by Willie Mays and the reports after the president picking him up, you know, on Air Force One and going with him to St. Louis, and Willie Mays recounting how he cried all night. He was in Chicago for the acceptance speech in Grant Park and crying all night because of what this moment meant to him. And I thought, darn, I wish I were a history teacher. And if you had the time to do this, and you probably don't, to incorporate that story. Because a lot of people watch in your class, watch the baseball game the night before and probably don't know, unless they're baseball fans, who Willie Mays was and how this was such an important event. And you know, how can you not teach that way? Because it was so moving to me to hear him so moved by the election.
Well, and there are a lot of things in what are frequently considered, you know, mere popular culture, whether it's athletics or whether it's popular music, that can really bring this material alive and are important. Back in the day when I was teaching AP US, I would use popular music when teaching about the Vietnam War, like Country Joe and the Fish, Spixin' to Die Rag. And when I would do seminars for teachers and suggest this was a route to take, there was always somebody who would say, that's not real history. And a few years ago, I had the great satisfaction of seeing the lyrics from Spixin' to Die Rag show up on the AP U.S. history exam. So it can be made relevant. It really can be made relevant. And somebody like Willie Mays, who grew up in a different era, who came out of Alabama to become a superstar baseball player, his reaction to Obama's election is very revealing. I agree with you. I think that the fact that we now have a real understanding of the links between, say, the Negro Leagues and the major leagues. There's a new biography out, Satchel Paige, that talks about Paige's barnstorming in the 20s and 30s.
Oh, great.
And how he was playing with and against white stars like Rogers Hornsby and Bob Feller. And this kind of sets the stage for Jackie Robinson. So Jackie Robinson no longer just comes out of nowhere.
Right.
But it does take time, you're right. And that's what I'm hearing a lot in Texas. We have to choose. It's a zero-sum game. If Thurgood Marshall is in, then Billy Graham won't be, and so we have to make that choice the other way. That makes no sense to me.
Yeah, I think most people would agree with you. You can't not include Thurgood Marshall. He's Thurgood Marshall.
No, really.
Yeah, you can't.
Saying that is a demonstration of fairly appalling ignorance.
We're going to take more phone calls in a moment. Ed, thanks very much for your call. Our number is 800-486-8655. One line is open, and our guest is Professor Luther Spare, Senior Lecturer in Education and History, Director of Undergraduate Studies, and the Department of Education is where he teaches Education and History at Brown University. He taught AP history in high school for some 18 years. And our conversation, in case you're just tuning in, prompted by an article you may want to read in the Wall Street Journal 2 days ago, The Culture War's New Front, U.S. History Classes in Texas. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We go back to phone calls. Chad is calling from Illinois. Hi, Chad.
Hi. I have more of a comment. It's dealing with the fact of putting religion and Christianity into the history books, and that's you can't just do it with just Christianity. American history is full of so many different types of religions that it requires all of them to be incorporated for it to be accurate.
Professor Spear?
Well, I think particularly in the last century or so, the caller's point is well taken. And I saw in the article that at least one of the committee members was suggesting that we needed to have more about Islam and so forth. The United States, in its national history, has been predominantly a Protestant nation in the 19th century, and Catholic immigration and so forth further complicated that picture at the end of the 19th and into the 20th. But there's a kind of common public literature that is used in the 19th century that is Christian, that is really important. You can't read Lincoln's first or second inaugural without an understanding of the rhythms and the cadences of the King James Version of the Bible. For that matter, you can't read Martin Luther King's I Have a Dream speech without that same understanding. So this is what I would term learning about religion and making sure that people have an understanding of that particular context. At the same time, again, the caller's point is well taken. Religious diversity increasingly is a factor in the United States, and it is a fact in the United States. And how we get to that is an interesting story. It's not always a matter simply of idealism, but a matter of self-preservation. Every little religious group is saying, in effect, I'll tolerate you guys if you'll tolerate me. Mm-hmm. And it's less a statement, again, of idealism than it is of self-interest. And that's an important point to understand, because that's the way we've evolved.
I was thinking back to the caller who said that he had neglected history until he went to that museum in Boston, and all of a sudden it was one of those moments in life when you say, oh, how could I have ignored this? This is wonderful. I'm wondering, as a teacher, and you teach teachers and were a high school teacher for a long period of time, what is the best way to have students achieve that moment? Is that purely an individual thing, or is it a certain kind of book that you know about that will open students' minds to the importance of this and get them excited about it? Is it a trip to a museum? What is it?
Well, again, you're trying to make it real and you're trying to make it matter. And in order to have that happen for students, they have to see history as a series of questions that they'll want to ask, that this stuff is happening to real people and that the answers aren't settled, that their job in class is not to read the teacher's mind and see which answer he prefers, but to sort out for themselves how great was Abraham Lincoln? How important as a president was Franklin Roosevelt? Was Franklin Roosevelt a better president than Herbert Hoover? Those aren't factual questions, and the students have to be sure from the beginning that you're not going to hold them to coming to the conclusion that you did. So you, in a sense, one of the buzzwords is problematize it. And once they see that there's no one answer, next they see that there's no one source. And there's all kinds of stuff out there, whether it's popular music or, I particularly for younger kids, that for everybody, recommend biographies that make an interpretation that can be argued and argued against. And that makes it come alive, and it makes it matter for them. And I think that's the key. We have a lot of emphasis on instant gratification these days, and history in some ways is a humbling discipline. It takes a while, but it rewards the patience that is put into it, because a student or you or I have one life. History gives us access to all kinds of interesting and amazing and important lives. And I guess I would say the shortest version of my answer would be to get some good biographies and then make sure that your teachers in the class open it up so that they know how important was William Lloyd Garrison to the abolitionist movement. Mm-hmm. There's not agreement on that. Well, what do you think? Would you have been persuaded by somebody who came on as strong as Garrison did, mm-hmm. or would you have been somebody who would have been saying, well, he seems like he's in an awful hurry. Let's slow down. Let's be a little more reasonable here. and again, you know, there's not a right answer to that. It's an argument or a position that can be defended, And to be defended thoroughly, you have to take into account the positions that other people are taking. So a multitude of sources, opening it up, making the students use their minds rather than simply absorb the alleged wisdom of the teacher.
Hmm. Oh, I want to take your class. Thanks, Chad, for the call. Let's go next to Wendy from Minnesota. Hi, Wendy.
Well, hello. I pulled off the interstate about 20 minutes ago, captivated by this conversation. I'm a very grateful mother, a 50-year-old mother who's driving home the last leg back to Minnesota. I had the privilege of driving my 16-year-old daughter out to Georgetown to the Junior Statesman Constitutional Law class.
Oh.
She's out there right now. The only reason she enrolled in that course of her own accord is that she is a graduate of last year's APUSH class, she called it, a survivor. They had T-shirts they actually made in the class because they all survived the class. And American Pageant was their book. The teacher drew them deeply into the stories. And the document questions work that you've done, Professor, has had extraordinary impact on kids as in places like Northfield, Minnesota, who have learned to go to primary sources, to cite where they're forming their opinions. We've had a very difficult time in our family, two parents catching up to the daughter and her brother, 2 years older, who've had this traumatic opportunity in a young age to learn how to think mm-hmm. and how, as you say, to find that historical context for today. And to draw from what they are learning, the relevance of these conversations to right now lets them read the newspaper better than we are as older people who were taught in a different time and a different way. This conversation is spot on to what I've just lived for the last week. And my daughter led me to take her down the Mason-Dixon line to go out to D.C. And we started at the Springfield Presidential Library that has just been opened. It is an extraordinary exhibit
yes.
celebrating Lincoln in a very gutsy way that invites us into the real difficulties of that family moving out to D.C. and how unwelcome they were and how extraordinary his conflict was. And we did stand in Lincoln's tomb with this daughter of mine reading his original words in those short statements, those inaugural speeches. She touched them last year. But to stand in his tomb, mm-hmm. seeing them in front of her, when she has to go out and decide, A or nay, should we take God out of the Pledge of Allegiance? It's one of the resolutions they have to decide this next 2 weeks.
Hmm.
She was drawn into, like the previous caller, this question. She sees religion in a much broader context than Christian way that he drew from it. She knows that text. She knows that rhythm. It is an extraordinary speech. All of them referenced, you know, people of Illinois, send me out there with wisdom. I face a more difficult time than even George Washington did. I need God to help us. He even says we might both be wrong. God might just, you know, be asking us to have this civil war. And she could see those words, and I just got the privilege of seeing this country and its history through her better understanding. And so my answer to you, I guess I'm going to go with your comment that maybe we need to listen to these kids who are graduates of this program and let them teach us what they've learned, because they're valuing this course. They value this course deeper than any adult around them. Those kids who are out there right now would testify authentically about how this helps them live their life and be more confident about this world's future. Because of AP U.S. history and world history, thank God for the people who are championing this. And I'm redoubling my efforts to say we have to offer this to more and more kids.
Wow, what a wonderful caller. Thank you so much. I'm glad you were listening, Wendy. Professor Spare.
What can I say?
Yeah.
I agree with every single word.
Mm-hmm.
I think the caller's students that she's familiar with, including her daughter, have had the moment that you're describing that people need to have, when all of a sudden the light comes on and this is stuff that happened to real people and it still matters now. And I really want to understand this, not simply in a celebratory way or in a way that glorifies the past, but that lets me really understand the complicated ways in which the past becomes the present. Personally, I don't find perfect heroes realistic or particularly interesting. It's the people like Lincoln who overcome frailties and doubts and vulnerabilities and still achieve what they achieve that strike me as truly worth studying, and a lot of other people find that to be true as well. So the ultimate bottom line to me is why study history? Well, there are all these reasons that we can talk about in connection with understanding, but it's also a source of great fun and great joy. And if you really get integrated into the study of history, you begin to see how superficial the approaches that are being taken by these advocates for who believe that the textbook is going to be what really shapes the student's attitude. That's not, I haven't heard one caller yet today say that it was the textbook.
No, nobody said that.
That made the difference.
Professor Spear, thank you so much for being with us. It was a great hour. Thank you.
Thank you.
Professor Luther Spear, senior lecturer in education and history at Brown University, 18 years spent in the classroom as an AP history teacher, high school level. Thanks to Rachel Biblow for producing this hour, to Jalema Noel for on-air production, and thanks everybody for all of your great calls. You were great. You always are, but today we were really great. News is coming up.